Hello and welcome to episode 100 of Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Despite the nationwide lockdown, which is now entering its fourth week, tens of thousands of Israelis demonstrated at hundreds of locations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Saturday night, in what's being called here the 1 kilometre protests. There were a handful of arrests, dozens of fines issued for violating the coronavirus restrictions, and reports of assaults by pro-Netanyahu thugs against protesters. The police, meanwhile, outdid themselves, letting down the tyres of protesters' bicycles, and one officer even spreading fake news that the Prime Minister movement had called on demonstrators to arm themselves with tear gas to attack police. There is, however, light at the end of the tunnel, as the Health Ministry unveils its 8-stage plan for ending the lockdown, which would see Israel returning to what passes as normal here within 4 months. Joining me to discuss the protests, the pandemic, the police and the politics, I'm joined in the studio by Anshul Pfeffer. How are you, Anshul?
Hi, Simon.
I think I've missed the window of opportunity for some good-natured soccer-related ribbing at your expense, so you've dodged a bullet.
You're talking about the Israel national team, I assume.
I wasn't, but you spur me on and I might talk about it. Joining us remotely today, it's a pleasure to welcome back Haaretz's diplomatic correspondent, Noah Landau.
Hi, Simon. Hi, Anshul.
Are you keeping well, Noah?
I hope so.
We hope so too. Noah, I said in the introduction that Israelis have been protesting despite the lockdown. Maybe I should have said because of the lockdown. I think a lot of people who demonstrated yesterday did so for the first time.
Well, of course, I think it's combined. It's both are true to some extent. Some of the protesters are protesting because of the lockdown, because they feel like the government is not really managing this well, and they would like to see less of a lockdown, more solutions to live our everyday lives, with the virus. And some of the people who are protesting are doing that because they feel that Netanyahu's efforts to prohibit the demonstrations and using the lockdown as an excuse is what they're protesting against.
Mm.
So I think both are true.
Mm. All right, so let's dive into the top story. The Health Ministry's 8-stage exit strategy to get Israel back on its feet. We'll get into the details of the plan shortly, but I did notice one striking thing about all the reporting of this story. Netanyahu's name is conspicuously missing. Given his dismal approval rating at the moment, is that deliberate? Is he no longer micromanaging Israel's pandemic response?
Well, of course, as the prime minister, it's his responsibility. All the bureaucracy doesn't matter. He's the one who is supposed to manage everything, whether, he's directly in charge or there's someone in charge of the project or just the health ministry. It doesn't matter. Mm. He's the boss. He's in charge. So maybe he wants to, shift the blame to someone else, but it doesn't mean that, he's not in charge.
Mm. So is he just maintaining a facade of distance? Is this his exit plan?
Of course he's trying to shift the blame, but every day when there are discussions about how Israel should handle this continuing situation, the prime minister is always at the head of the table, or should I say head of the virtual Zoom discussion, because that's how things are happening now. But he's still the one who is managing it, and it doesn't really matter if what he wants to show. Of course, because everything is a massive failure, he would want to distance himself.
Until it becomes a success. What about the plan itself? Obviously, as our health correspondent Ido Efrati reports, it's subject to change as it's brought before the coronavirus cabinet. At first glance, it seems pretty unpolitical.
The problem right now in Israel is that there's a huge gap between what's written and all those beautiful plans and reality.
Mm.
In the end, you have all these different reports and projects and solutions that all these various different bodies are bringing to the table. And then there's a massive gap between what's written and what the government actually approves, because that's when they're supposed to approve these programs. This is where the political pressures are happening, and each minister wants to represent a different sector of society. And this is where the problems really occur, at that stage when the government is supposed to approve something. And this is where we find this gap in the end. So, you know, everything sounds great on paper. The problem is it never happens, as it's written in the paper.
Mm. And the two stumbling blocks presumably remain the prohibition on demonstrations and synagogues, right?
Well, I think there are two sectors of society which were always, and probably you'll speak more about this with Anshin, because I saw he wrote some very interesting columns about this, which I fully agree with. The problems we had before the pandemic, which were around different sectors of society that have less faith in the government and are running as kind of like autonomies outside of the government's reach, which is the ultra-Orthodox and to some extent the Arab society. When you have a pandemic, you see that these problems are only getting bigger, but they were there before. And what we see now is that those two societies would also have like different political mechanisms. The ultra-Orthodox actually have a lot of strength in the government and the ability to pressure Netanyahu. The Arabs don't, but it's still the same problem, that those populations have less faith in the central government. So that's one of the problems. The other one, as you said, is that Netanyahu really wants to prohibit demonstrations against them or limit them in some way, and it seems like his attention is totally around that issue more than the others.
And yet this plan, the first stage of this plan includes lifting the ban on demonstrations, but synagogues will only open next month in stage two. And of the 14 towns that remain red and lockdown is supposed to remain in effect, several are predominantly Haredi.
You know, Simon, I'm asking myself, where does this whole comparison start between demonstrations and synagogues? Mm. And the answer is Netanyahu. He's the one who wants, you know, to compare these two. And I'm not sure we should compare them. I mean, synagogues, or not, it's not only about synagogues, it's about religious practice in general. You know, if it happens in spaces that are smaller and tend to be more friendly to the virus spread, then it's a problem that demonstrations really are not a part of. There's a will to kind of like compare these two, but I'm not sure that health-wise, scientifically-wise, and for many other reasons, we actually should compare them.
Mm. So it is political, as always. Anshul, how will the ultra-Orthodox community react if the ban on demonstrations is lifted, according to this plan, but their yeshivas and their synagogues and a lot of their main population centres remain on lockdown?
Well, I totally agree with Noah. It's an artificial comparison used by Netanyahu and his media outriders or proxies, and sadly some people in the media have adopted this comparison, and we should totally reject it. There's an argument over whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing to protest in large numbers. Now, that's an argument which is a valid argument, but it has nothing to do with what's happening within the ultra-Orthodox community. Going back 7-8 months, we had a very similar issue with the ultra-Orthodox community that we're having now, and there were no protests then. And I can assure you that even if there were no protests now, we'd be having exactly the same problems with the ultra-Orthodox community. The ultra-Orthodox community have their reasons, and once again, we can disagree with or agree with some of those reasons, but they have their reasons for keeping the yeshivot open, for keeping synagogues open, for continuing to gather in large numbers for events like Hakafot Shniot at the end of Simchat Torah, or Simchat Bet HaShoeva during the most recent week, Simchat Bet HaShoeva in Chol HaMoed Sukkot, and then going back Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, and everything else. All these things are happening without any connection to outside factors. The ultra-Orthodox community has a problem with the pandemic and has a problem in in dealing with the pandemic according to the government regulations and to the public health recommendations. It's a community which is based on worshipping in large numbers together and studying Torah in large numbers together. And those are really the fundamental foundations for this community. And another of the foundations of the community is a self-isolation and rejecting outside advice or outside orders. So all these things totally run contradictory to the Haredi ethos, to the ultra-Orthodox way of life. And the government has really no way to impose these things on it. And since the Haredi parties are a major part of the Netanyahu coalition, also Netanyahu has no political motivation to force them to do it, because he can't give, without their support, he's no longer prime minister. So this whole comparison of the protest is being used by Netanyahu, by Haredi politicians, obviously, who have a problem here, so they need some kind of excuse to excuse the way their own community is behaving. But really, it's a total fabrication. It's not the reason why the Haredim are doing what they're doing.
So this lockdown that started 3 weeks ago and was ratcheted up 2 weeks ago into a full nationwide lockdown, it seems to have succeeded in getting the number of new infections down and easing the stress on hospitals, right? It's got the R and the N numbers down.
So we can see so far. I mean, it still is early to say, but it looks slightly optimistic. Now, we may have just turned the corner, but it really is something that the experts are warning quite rightly. We should give it a few more days before we're certain that the trend has totally gone downwards.
It hasn't, however, managed to get what I'm calling the CH index down, the chutzpah index. Is it too much to ask that ministers, Shin Bet officials, people who happen to be married to the prime minister, abide by the same rules as everybody else?
You know, I was looking a bit earlier through the list of all the powerful politicians, senior officials, family members of senior politicians. Not one has paid a price, perhaps beyond the standard fine. I'm not even sure that they've all paid that. You know, and I was just looking now in what's happening in Britain. An MP who broke the regulations by going around when she was infected has been forced to resign from Parliament. And this is just like so many other examples. You know, around the world, if you're in a senior position and you're seen to have broken the regulations, you can lose your job for it. I think the biggest penalty that any of Israeli politician has faced for breaking regulation is Miki Levy in Yesh Atid has left the Coronavirus Affairs Committee. And it's basically, it's not, you know, okay, he won't be able to grandstand and make big speeches there, but that's the extent of the penalties that any Israeli politician or senior official has paid for breaking. And you know, you call it the chutzpah level. It's just a sign of the chaos that there is here, because yes, we're in a lockdown. There's less movement on the roads. Businesses are closed. 100,000 people are out of a job. But by and large, you don't get the feeling that the country is really taking this seriously, and it comes from the very top.
And of course, we can say what we like about these people because we have no aspirations to coach the national soccer team, right?
You're referring to, yes, to Eyal Berkovic and Miri Regev's stormy exchange on Friday evening on television, where Miri Regev told Eyal Berkovic, who a week previously had said, I think it was to Miki Zohar, the kosher whip, that Likud is an organized crime group, and she said until he apologizes, he won't be the manager of the national football team, which some would argue is not such a bad thing. But yeah, that's that was more of a comic interlude, I think.
Angel, before we move on before we move on to politics, but let's rephrase that and say dive deeper into politics. A word for our colleague Jacob Kornbluh, who was beaten by pro-Trump, ultra-Orthodox protesters in Brooklyn last week for advocating wearing masks and adhering to the COVID restrictions. How did Trump manage to get these God-fearing Jews to do his dirty work?
Well, in the same way that Netanyahu, who is equally godless, an equally godless sinner as Trump is, has made the ultra-Orthodox parties an iron part of his coalition here. There is a sense of alliance between between the resentment and the outsiderishness that that Trump has built around himself. Mm. Trump is not an outsider; he's a man who's, but, you know, son of a millionaire, lost many millions himself as over the years, and has never known a day of hardship in his life. But he still manages to broadcast to various resentful underdog groups this feeling that we're together, we're in this together against the deep state, against the establishment, against the elites, against the swamp. And, you know, this kind of feeling of kinship does broadcast very strongly to today's ultra-Orthodox psyche, that they're sort of the outsiders both within the Jewish establishment, and they need this kind of feeling of hostility from the outside world, and Trump feeds that. And I think one of the myths that the Haredim are trying to, both in the United States and in Israel, are trying to build around the coronavirus crisis, is that they are fighting against this terrible enemy who doesn't just want to spread the virus against them, but also wants to end all Jewish life. And, you know, by closing synagogues and by closing yeshivot, this will be such a fatal thing for Jewish life. It's better to continue exposing ourselves to COVID-19 and carrying on studying and carrying on praying in large groups. Mm.
No, let's roll up our sleeves, hold our noses, and talk coalition politics. A TV poll last week found that the right-wing Yamina party is closing the gap on Netanyahu's Likud. If elections were held today, Likud would pick up 26 seats, 10 fewer than it did in March, while Naftali Bennett's Yamina would win 23 seats, up from just 6 in the March election. So whilst Netanyahu scrambles around for Israel's COVID exit strategy, would it be fair to say that more and more Israelis are looking for an exit strategy from Netanyahu?
Well, we always, you know, we always feel that this is the case, and then, you know, elections happen and we see that that's not actually the case. So I don't want to predict, you know, what we'll actually see in an election, but it's fair to say that you know, we are in a continuous mode of elections as we speak. Everyone's trying to guess when will we see these elections, because I just want to remind our listeners, we don't have a budget, and the coalition is very fragile, of course. And, you know, people say that it might be around March, but it doesn't even matter if we'll see elections in, you know, a few months or a little bit later this year. In the end, we are in a continuous campaign all the time. Mm. This government from day one was actually in a campaign towards the next election. And regarding Bennett, it's very interesting to see how, you know, it's almost impossible to predict his political future, because he almost even didn't have one seat in the Knesset just recently in one of, you know, the second elections, I think it was. And now suddenly he's threatening Likud. I don't know. It feels like a public opinion shifts really, really quickly. So it's hard to say what will happen before the actual election.
Mm. The chairman of the coalition, Miki Zohar, said today that elections are an excellent option now. He claimed that Kahol Levan has breached coalition agreements. Hot air?
So as I said, we're in a constant mode of elections. You know, Miki Zohar, one of Netanyahu's main mouthpieces at the moment, he just shows that, you know, this is a continuous campaign. We're in it all the time, and that's how we should examine these statements.
Mm. And today's Haaretz editorial spoke about the state budget and how Netanyahu is holding the state budget hostage for political reasons. This is going to be a major issue in the weeks ahead, right?
So the budget is the most important issue, I think, and the most problematic one. The fact that this government is not really functioning, it's a disaster in terms of handling COVID, but it's also a disaster handling the economical situation in midst of COVID, and in general, operating without a budget is totally dysfunctional. Mm. The government is in a dysfunctional mode, and again, it's all because of Netanyahu's political situation at the moment. So, yes, I think in the end, the budget will probably determine the final date of election.
Our colleague Chaim Levinson wrote a piece saying that Likud was surprised that the bungled response to the pandemic has hurt its popularity. You can almost hear the sarcasm in Chaim's headline, can't you? He also reports that Bibi's decided that the normalization accords with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain aren't giving him the boost that he's hoped for. Is he worried?
I'm sure he's worried, and you can see that when you see all the various campaign mode little Facebook posts, and he issues videos all the time that look like he's trying to kind of boost the support. But so I'm sure he is worried. You can see that from the way they operate. But again, in the end, public opinion in Israel is really shaky at the moment. And I don't know if it really predicts something, toward the real election. Because as much as Bennett is now rising, I don't really think he's a serious opponent against Netanyahu. So, yes, Netanyahu is right now, there's a problem and he has less support and so on, but the real test will be come election day.
Chaim suggests that he could try and boost his support by firing Gila Gamliel. So let's keep our eyes on that. He ends his piece, Chaim, by saying that a Trump victory on November the 3rd could help Netanyahu change the narrative here and whet his party's appetite for an early election, and that conversely, a Biden triumph could shake up the government in Jerusalem with unforeseen consequences. I can't really bring myself to contemplate a Trump win, so let's focus on what a Biden presidency would mean for Bibi. Good, bad, irrelevant?
So, of course, a Biden government for Bibi is a problem. Of course, he will have to show that he could form the same warm relationship that he had with President Trump before. It will not be easy. But on the other hand, I don't think it's impossible. I mean, we tend to think, okay, so Netanyahu and Trump were obviously on the same line, and it will be a problem for Netanyahu to kind of deal with Biden. But I'm not sure that if we look at the Israel-U.S. relations during, you know, all these past years since they began, I don't think that if you look at the larger picture, it will be really a problem. Because in the end, Biden is a mainstream Democrat, and he has been a supporter of Israel before, he had relations with AIPAC and so on. I don't think his views on Israel are going to be that of a change for Netanyahu. I think he can handle that. And more than that, I don't think that Bibi's future in Israel depends on Trump or Biden that much.
Anshul?
Well, I agree with Noah. I don't think that a Biden-Harris administration, assuming the polls are correct and they're about to win in 3 weeks, will cause any major change, certainly not in the near future, to the Israel-U.S. Relationship. They're both quite pro-Israel, and they have other priorities right now which are much more domestic rather than foreign policy ones. I do think, and this is where I perhaps differ a bit from Noah, that the effect of whatever the result is in the United States will influence Netanyahu and his decision making. Netanyahu has one major question looming over him, was if and when does he try and hold another election? Because Netanyahu needs an election to pass the laws which will allow him to evade the legal process currently against him, which will save him from court. And that factor doesn't change. As long as Netanyahu doesn't think he can get that majority, he's not going to risk another election. The moment he thinks that that's a possibility, and right now the polls are saying that he'll be too weakened by assuming Naftali Bennett gets anywhere near what the polls are saying, he won't be in a position to be able to dictate his own terms, and he's not going to run. But he has sort of almost a metaphysical feeling towards Donald Trump, and he feels ever since Trump won in 2016, and let's remember, Netanyahu was not that much of a pro-Trump fan before the election in November 2016. He was, I'd say, he was agnostic whether it would be better for him to have Trump or have Hillary Clinton. But once Trump won, despite the polls at the time, and Trump, you know, in his own, you know, very unique fashion. Netanyahu was saying to his advisors, be Trump, be like Trump. And we can see the way Netanyahu has been aping Trump, and Trump a bit aping Netanyahu over the last 4 years. And I think a Trump victory, as we know, it's not the, it doesn't seem very likely from the polls. Netanyahu will feel in a way that this is a wind in his sails. And I think that if Trump does defy expectations to win in November, then Netanyahu will very soon after that call an election, because he'll feel that this is proof that he's a winner, just like Donald Trump. And if Trump loses, I think Netanyahu will be extremely cautious about calling an election. But this is more on the level of his own personal feelings. Whether it'll change the feelings of the Israeli electorate towards him, I think there is a chance that a Trump losing will have some effect, because right now Israelis see Netanyahu as the best friend of the President of the United States. And that's an asset. It, you know, has it helped Netanyahu very much in the recent elections? Perhaps not, because there are other reasons for people not to vote Netanyahu. But it will certainly be something which will diminish Netanyahu's power in the eyes of the Israeli electorate. And don't forget, in the second of the three elections that we had now, their entire Likud campaign was based around photographs of Netanyahu and Trump standing together and showing Netanyahu as being this this statesman of similar stature to the President of the United States. So there will be an effect. It may not be a major effect, but there will be some effect, both on Netanyahu personally and on the Israeli electorate, I think, from whatever happens next month in the United States.
So to paraphrase the Donald himself, Israelis prefer presidents who don't lose elections.
You know, I just want to remind us that Netanyahu has been elected in Israel also when Barack Obama was in office. So you can also claim that the fact that he's, you know, even when he was perceived as, you know, by some people as guarding Israel from the U.S. president, or, you know, that's how he wanted it to look like, even then he was elected. So it depends. You can tell the story, you know, both ways.
I'm sure he'll find a way to spin it to his advantage when the time comes.
But we have to remember that back in 1999, when Israelis loved Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton seemed as being, you know, was overtly hostile towards Netanyahu, Netanyahu lost big time. I think Netanyahu, in one sense, managed to beat Obama by defining Obama for Israelis. And Obama sort of gave him the opportunity by not coming to Israel early in the term and being pretty openly hostile to Israel. So unlike Clinton, who Israelis felt was Israel's friend, Netanyahu managed to create this false impression that Obama hates Israel and he's some kind of closet anti-Semite or something. And that's one of the reasons why, as Noah said, it actually helped Netanyahu to be seen as defending Israel from Obama. I don't think Netanyahu will be able to do the same thing to Biden and Harris in the way he did it to Obama. I think they are already seen by many Israelis as being pro-Israel, perhaps not in the same way Trump is, but it'll be very difficult for Netanyahu to immediately portray, assuming there is a new Democratic administration in Washington, as being inherently anti-Israel.
Right, exactly. So it's less about who's the president, more about what kind of story would Netanyahu tell about that president and him.
It's always about the narrative.
Exactly.
Yeah. Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time for this week. Thank you for joining us, Noah.
Thank you.
And to you too, Anshul. Thanks to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again next week with another episode. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.